Boo.
I am delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Now, among your many books, of course, you got lots of famous books. You got The Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II. That was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And you're going to be on featured in Ken Burns' upcoming PBS documentary on the Roosevelts.
That is correct. I'm so glad, actually, because the people that I've spent time with, including Teddy Roosevelt and then Franklin and Eleanor, you know, years of my life. And so to have that chance to work with Ken, who I've worked with before on baseball, on the same group of people, it has really been a grand experience.
And that's called The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. And that's great. Well, you spent 7 years working on this project. And you write that you set out with the intention of writing about Theodore Roosevelt and the Progressive Era, but it became something much more than that. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. I mean, I think I always start the subject, somebody that I want to live with, because I know it's going to take me a long period of time. And I've always been interested in Teddy Roosevelt from the time I taught a seminar on him way back when I was starting to teach at Harvard. But I knew there'd been some wonderful recent books on him, so I couldn't just do a biography. So it happened that I started early on reading a series of letters. I always love letters. Letters and diaries are my favorite sources as a historian. They're so intimate. And I found a series of 400 letters between Teddy and Taft and realized they'd been friends from the time they were young and that they had really grown up together in many ways, and their families knew each other and their children, that Teddy had sponsored his going over to the governor generalship of the Philippines when he came back, brought him into his cabinet, was his closest advisor. It made him his successor in 1908, and then ended up running against him, his old friend, in 1912. So I just knew instinctively that that was a story that had drama and conflict and sadness and emotion that I wanted to tell. So Taft became a figure to study as equal to Teddy, which I never would have imagined at the beginning.
Most of us think of the picture of Taft sitting on that poor horse, or, you know, as the wrong guy in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt was running on the Bull Moose ticket and Taft was defending what seemed like the old guard at the time. And you write that this is three interwoven strands. You also talk about the bully pulpit.
Correct. What I discovered is rather than that Taft was not carrying out Teddy's legacy, he really was just unable to do the one thing that Teddy did so well, which was to be a public leader, to use the bully pulpit to move the country to actions that the old guard in Congress didn't want them to do. So Teddy had mastered his relationship with the press and brilliantly became partners with them and was able, especially with the muckraker journalists, to take advantage of their investigative stories to get people upset about corruption in the cities or Standard Oil or food and drug problems, and then Congress would finally have to take action. Whereas Taft was a very just, able, amiable, really lovely man, but had no desire to give those kind of fighting speeches. He was really a judge by temperament. He thought if you made a decision, it just explained itself. So when the country started moving even further along, he couldn't keep up with it, really. And so that's when I realized I needed to study the journalists because they were such a part of Teddy's success and of Taft's failure. So they became the third thread of this story.
Yeah. Can you take a minute and tell us a little more about Taft? Because to most of us, he's just, you know, that one picture, really. And he sort of led a parallel life to Roosevelt. He rose almost as quickly as Roosevelt rose through the ranks.
Absolutely. No, I mean, he came from a middle-class family who had settled in Cincinnati. His father was a judge. His father was actually in the cabinet under Grant. From the time he was young, there was a sense of his wanting to please his parents and his people, so he worked hard in school, graduated second in his class at Yale, went to law school, did very well at law school, became a very young judge just at the time when Teddy becomes a very young politician, and dreams that someday he might be on the Supreme Court. But because of his amiable temperament, he was then appointed to be Solicitor General in Washington, which was more of a political position than simply a judge position, although it had to do with being a judge. And that's where he met Teddy when Teddy was Civil Service Commissioner, and they formed that great bond. And then he was appointed an even higher judge, was so happy to go back to Cincinnati to be an appeals court judge, but then, surprisingly, got appointed Governor General of the Philippines and wasn't sure about whether to go or not, but he was promised that if he came back, that judicial position would be still there for him. And it turned out he was well-suited for that position. He was very open with the Filipino people. It was a difficult situation. He went about among them, became close to them. His wife, Nellie, was an extraordinary first lady for the Philippines, really opened up the doors of the courthouse, the county house, to lots of people of different races. And then Teddy calls him back to be in his cabinet, and he's the most important person in Teddy's cabinet. And then Teddy wants him to run when he's not running in 1908. And reluctantly, he agrees to run, even though some side part of him knows this is not what I really love, politics. It's the judicial world that I love. But he does run. Nellie wants him to run. Teddy wants him to run. He wins the race. And then he's sort of in a position that he never really wanted to be. And unfortunately, if you don't love politics, he said even right away, he felt like a fish out of water. And then Nellie had a stroke within weeks. Devastating. She could have been for him like Eleanor was for Franklin Roosevelt. He spent so much time with her that the presidency did seem to lose focus. So when Teddy comes back from Africa, his progressive friends tell him, we're not moving as fast as we need to. And eventually he decides to run against his old friend. And that's what produces that split in the Bull Moose Party. But that whole story beforehand was something I knew so little about that's what was so made it heartbreaking to see the rupture between them, because the friendship had been so strong.
And Taft, from his earliest days, and this was a big surprise when I read this, was really such a devoted reformer from his earliest days in Cincinnati.
No, his temperament, too, like Teddy's, was against corruption, against the bosses, against what was going on when the civil service system was being undone by patronage. And even he was for breaking up the trusts. He actually broke up more than Teddy did. It was just that he stepped into a very difficult situation in trying to lower the tariff, and they took advantage of his not knowing how to deal with the Congress well enough and didn't produce as good a tariff as he thought they would. He got screwed up on certain kinds of conservation things, not again from the wrong outcome, but the wrong way of doing it. And mostly, he just didn't explain himself as a public leader, so the country lost faith in him. And that opened the door for Teddy to say, I have to run this banner. I need to come back.
Right. And Taft was more of an older-style politician, if you will, that he thought the record spoke for itself, and he didn't really have to go out and, defend his record or anything. So
no, that's exactly right. And that would be true if you're a judge. You make a decision, and then you're not going around the country defending the decision. The words speak for themselves. So he thought he was doing the right thing, and eventually the words would speak for themselves. But, of course, politics is never like that.
Yeah.
You have to convince the public and convince them over and over again. And he would wait too long to write his speeches because he didn't like to do it. He was a procrastinator. That was the great thing about Teddy. He would, when he knew he had a speech to give, months ahead of time he would start it so he wouldn't worry about it, which was a great lesson to me. Every time I'd start putting off something, I'd think, I better start it now.
You're going to end up like Taft if you're not
worrying about it.
Right, exactly. So, you have one chapter entitled The Insider and the Outsider, and that really seemed to sum up the difference between the two, even though they shared many values, is that Taft worked his way through and sat down at the job and sort of was meticulous and worked, and Teddy was always the outsider in the back of the room stirring things up.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Taft made his way up the ladder in part because people expected his work ethic. He was so kind and good to the people he worked with. He didn't take credit away from his bosses. He was the ideal number two person, so he kept getting pushed up the ladder. And it all worked, really, until he got into the presidency. And then, then you're in a different position than you are when you're working as the Secretary of War or even as Governor General of the Philippines, because the Secretary of War then, Elihu Root, was in charge of him. Whereas Teddy, from the beginning, from the first days in the state legislature, was making his name by making fiery speeches, and organizing against the bosses. When he gets to the civil service, he organizes the press against what's going on. And the people he works for often are frustrated by him. When he gets to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he wants so much to be making the decisions that when his boss goes away in the summertime, this is shortly before the Spanish-American War, he's writing to him saying, it's really hot in Washington. Don't come back. Nothing's going on here.
Trust me.
And he takes steps, that the boss might not have taken to move us closer to the Spanish-American War. But he had that ambition and forcefulness and aggression that Taft never had.
if you look at the timeline for Teddy Roosevelt, it seems like he changes job almost every year. He's in the back of the room yelling about something. The next year, he's in a different room yelling about something. But from the very earliest beginning, when he's with the state legislature in New York, he really understands the importance of cultivating reporters. And he develops powerful, you call them reciprocal relationships with members of the press. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's really the key to his success. I mean, especially because he did see himself as almost like a preacher to the country, you know, morally telling them where America had to move in dealing with the Industrial Revolution problems. So very early on, as you say, even when he's in Albany, he begins to make friends with the reporters there. And I think the key to the relationship was that he genuinely liked them. I mean, he was a writer himself, so he respected good writing. And he was confident enough that he could take their criticism without ending the relationship, so that they felt free that their integrity was not on the line because they could criticize him. So he made friends with them in Albany. He then made friends later with the investigative reporters when he was president. He made friends with them in Washington. All the way along the line, there were a series of people. I mean, the funniest story is when he was in the Spanish-American War and that he wrote a memoir. And in the memoir, he talked about all the places that he was. And a journalist wrote to a review of it and said he was so self-centered in a way, he should have called it Alone in Cuba, as if he'd been the only person there. But instead of getting angry, he wrote to the journalist, who was a famous humorist, actually, Finley Peter Dunne, and said, "I regret to tell you that my wife and my family absolutely adored your review of my book. Now you must meet me, because I've always wanted to meet you." And at first, Dunne was hesitant because he wanted to not lose his critical ability to make fun of Teddy. But then he did meet him, they became friends, and he still made fun of him, and it was still okay.
Now some of these reporters became real mentors to Theodore Roosevelt as he developed his understanding of the progressive needs of the country. And even from when he was police commissioner in New York City, he had a relationship with Jacob Riis and Lincoln Steffens, where they really began to mentor him and to be educators to him.
Without a question. I mean, when he first got into the police commissioner role, he knew he didn't know about what was going on in the streets. What were the policemen responding to? Where was the corruption that people worried about coming from? And these reporters had been part of it. I mean, Riis had written about poverty. Lincoln Steffens had written about the police department. So, in fact, Riis is the one who recommended that he go out at night disguised between 2 and 6 in the morning and just see which policemen were on the beat and which ones were sitting around drinking or talking or with a girl. And then he would be able to single out which guys were doing their job and which weren't. And those midnight rambles, as he called them, became part of his learning. And then Riis took him into tenements in the middle of the night where he could see much easier than in the day how horrible the situations were, you know, or to some of the cigar factories. So one of the good things about him moving from one job to the other is that his experience just kept growing from one thing to another. So by the time he became president, you know, he'd had experience in the state assembly, in the police commissioner's role, in the civil service role, you know, as governor, in the Rough Riders, as vice president, although that probably was the least helpful to him since the vice presidency was so unpowerful in those days.
William Allen White, who was a journalist at the time, talked about the appearance of progressive newspapers and magazines moving the country to move forward, allowing the country to move forward in their push to realize a better world. And this was the investigative journalists. Can you talk about this? Because a lot of the newspapers were against Roosevelt. It was these new progressive magazines and newspapers, especially, you know, McClure's. Could you talk a little bit about McClure's?
No, I mean, it really, it's true. There were a lot of tabloid newspapers out at the time. There were a lot of newspapers owned by conservatives that the last thing they wanted was a progressive movement to be developing in the country or under Teddy Roosevelt. But there were these magazines that came out, and particularly McClure's, which was considered probably the most important progressive magazine. And it had in its family of journalists all these journalists that are now still, you know, considered golden: Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens and Ray Baker, William Allen White. And he gave them time to do their work on a salaried basis, so they could really investigate, as Ida Tarbell did Standard Oil, or Ray Baker, the abuses of the railroad, or Lincoln Steffen, the corruptions of the city. And then, incredibly, they'd produce these huge pieces, 10,000, 20,000-word pieces, which would be serialized over the period of a year or so, once a month in the magazine, and people gobbled them up. I mean, that was an age of reading magazines, where the magazines were king in a certain sense, because they were national in a way that the newspapers were just beginning to become. And they would give them to friends, they formed a common conversation, and all of these journalists became national figures as a result. Ida Tarbell considered the Joan of Arc for exposing Standard Oil, and Ray Baker considered the best journalist of his generation. But they all helped each other and were part of this family. So that became another thread of the story, to write about their lives. And they felt they had a mission at the time and a calling that was making a difference in the world, which it was. And their parents had been the Civil War generation. And one of them said, "So we with our pen rather than the sword are trying to make this country better." And it's quite moving, because when they get older, they meet when they're in their 80s and look back on this period as the most fulfilling of their lives.
Now, a magazine like McClure's was really appealing to a new class in America. One of McClure's strategies was to not price it at 35 cents an issue, but to price it at 15 cents an issue. So he was going after a different kind of audience than people had gone after before. Could you talk about that a little bit?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the other magazines, the Century Magazine or the Atlantic, you know, that was really the literary elite that could afford a 35-cent magazine. So when he got it priced at first 10 cents and 15%, it meant that the young middle class could read these magazines and become devoted readers of the magazines. And then it wasn't just McClure's, but then other magazines followed his lead. So suddenly you have a whole group of these investigative magazines that do the same thing, hire very good people to do these investigations, price it much lower than it used to be, and you've got a reading public that has influence on Congress and on the senators because they have numbers on their side.
One of the many wonderful things about your book is the time you devote to the women in this story, and I'd like to just take a minute to talk about one of them. That's Ida Tarbell. Can you give us a little thumbnail description of Ida Tarbell and her importance during this time?
Oh, I'd be glad to. In fact, one of the thoughts I have, Steven Spielberg has gotten the rights to do a movie on Teddy and Taft, but we've also talked about, since the book has so many different parts to it,
right,
it could be a separate miniseries or even maybe a movie on Ida Tarbell and the Muckraker journalist. But she's the heart of the Muckraker journalist. So here she is, a young woman growing up in Pennsylvania, and somehow there's ambition in her from the time she's young, and she goes to college. She's the only female in Allegheny College in her freshman year, and she wants to be a writer, and she comes out, and she works on a local newspaper, the Chautauquan magazine, and she decides she wants to go to Paris to write a biography, and he taunts her, the editor, saying, "What are you going to do in Paris? How will you support yourself? You're not a writer. You'll starve." She goes to Paris, and she does freelance articles while she's working on this biography. McClure sees one of them, Sam McClure, and he comes up 80 steps to her little terrible place in Paris, and he says, "You're going to write for me." So she comes back eventually and works for McClure's, and eventually, after doing a series on Lincoln and Napoleon, he puts her on to Standard Oil, because her father had been in the oil business, a small business person, and had been destroyed by John D. Rockefeller. So she had the emotional connection to the story, but she insisted she do it as an objective, you know, hard-ranking historian kind of reporter. And her series of J.D. Rockefeller's life, which was intertwined with his building the Standard Oil and really undoing so many companies along the way with unfair means, became really the impetus for creating the first Bureau of Corporations to regulate corporations and eventually breaking up Standard Oil. And then she becomes world famous.
And she goes on from there. She continues.
And then she goes on from there, and she studies the tariff, and she goes on, she studies women. The sad drama part of the story is that I think in some ways she probably always loved McClure. She never got married. They had a very close relationship. And he ran around with, he not only was married, but he ran around with some other women. And it all came to a bad end inside the magazine, because he had a certain manic depressiveness, and He would sometimes go off on ideas that made no sense, and eventually all of them left him and formed their own magazine, which never really had the power of McClure's, nor did McClure's without them have the same power. But years later, when they'd get together, you know, all those friendships came back in the remembrance of that time when it was so golden.
When Teddy Roosevelt was governor, he delivered in 1900 his second annual report to the Assembly, and he was proposing all these reforms to address the regulate the trusts and the monopolies, and it really didn't go anywhere. While working people and people in the West were very much concerned about this, the middle class didn't seem to get it. They didn't seem to really, you know, feel that this was a threat to them. But you write about how from 1900 to about 1904, Tarbell and the other muckrakers just created this public understanding, especially among the middle class, of the dangers posed by these kind of things.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that was the genius of McClure, because he said, and Teddy understood too, that it was too abstract when you talked about these trusts, you know, and interlocking directorates and the same people owning the railroads and that owned the oil companies. It just didn't have a human dimension to it. So he was the one who came up with the idea, McClure, saying, why don't we write about the mother of trusts, Standard Oil, and why don't we write it through a biography of a man, J.D. Rockefeller? Since she had already done Lincoln and already done Napoleon, she had an instinctive biographical capacity. I mean, had she been an historian in today's world, I think she'd be a famous biographer today or a famous historian. And by making it personal, and, you know, there were times when she may have gone too hard after J.D. Rockefeller, but other times when she gave him his due for his organizational genius. But she studied depositions, she went and interviewed people the way you would do with a biography, and she made him come alive and the creation of Standard Oil so people saw how unfair means were used to create this giant monopoly. And then that's what each one of the other writers did. They made human stories out of these larger issues, and that's what people respond to. There's something in all of us, I think, that responds to a story that has a beginning, middle, and an end.
This culminated in 1904 and 1905 with huge reforms that Theodore Roosevelt was able to, you know, to lead. The Northern Securities merger decision, the breakup of Standard Oil, the 59th Congress, he got legislation about meat inspection, the Pure Food and Drug Act, the regulating railroad rates. These were huge victories. And he himself thought that at the end of that, he wouldn't be able to accomplish much more.
That is true. Turned out to be true. I mean, I think he had an instinct. Two instincts. One, he knew that he had already promised that he wasn't going to run for a third term, so he could see that his power would probably be waning after this 1906, because he would have only till 1908, and people would be focused on the next person. But I think he also knew that the country goes through these spasms of reform, and that after a while, they tire of it. And that's been true in our history, and he just instinctively understood that. And in addition to that, some of the other investigative reporters who weren't as careful and as hardworking and objectively factually as my guys were at McClure's were taking after rich people, you know, and really undoing them just for the pleasure of undoing them, sometimes with stories that weren't true or facts that weren't right, and people started turning against them. And that's when actually Teddy used the word, which later became a badge of honor. There are these muckrakers that just look at what's wrong with the society rather than what's right. And the McClure's guys were really the opposite, because they saw what was wrong only to shed light on it so that things would get better. They were a very optimistic bunch. But anyway, that became the term muckrakers. And then later in, you know, generations later, to be a muckraker was considered, yes, you want to be a muckraker. And those guys were some of the best in history.
Right about the same time, McClure's magazine was having its own problems, and there reporters, these investigative reporters, really started to, they lost their forum when they left McClure's, and the whole movement toward investigative journalism and these, I don't want to say moral crusades, but this real public interest started to wane, and people got, there was some kind of fatigue or something that set in.
I think that's exactly right. So everything conspired in a way, you know, the fact that Teddy's power was coming to an end, the fact that McClure's had broken up, which, you know, really had little to do with that. It had more to do with McClure having had an affair with this woman, and the letters were found, and they were afraid they'd be exposed, and he was in one of his manic states, and he tried to then create something even bigger than McClure's, which they thought would lose their magazine, and they just broke with him. And that could have happened at any time. It happened then. But because it happened in 06, and their magazine never had the same power that McClure's did, and Teddy didn't have the same power he did, that whole investigative tradition, I think, did begin to wane. And then after a while, business interests started buying up these magazines, and then slowly the editorial policy would start to change. So eventually, even the magazine that Ida and Ray Baker and Lincoln Steffens founded on their own got bought up by somebody, and they finally all left it because they no longer had the same power they had once had. So it's partly just times changing and partly a whole bunch of events coming together that caused this to happen. But there was a permanent legacy left, as you pointed out, in that regulatory legislation that got passed in 1906. I mean, that was the highlight.
There are so many things, as you read this book, that are live issues at this moment in our history. Again, you know, you write about how very rarely, but several times, this country has gone through transformations and molts, you say. It becomes almost another country. Is there a hope of that again, do you think?
I think there has to be. You know, whenever we're in one of those periods where it just seems like we're stuck and we don't know how to deal with the problems that have arisen, and there is some similarity, I think, between the Industrial Revolution just so shifted the economic order at the turn of the 20th century in terms of people moving from the farms to the city, the inventions had speeded up life so much, and these big corporations are forming, and small business feels like it's being cut out. The middle class felt squeezed. The rich and the poor have a huge gap. We have some of that today again between the technological revolution and the globalization, middle class being squeezed, and billionaires side by side with people who are really struggling. And it seems to us like, how do we deal with this? It seems too hard. And yet it seemed to these people in the 1890s, when the labor strikes were going on and there was a lot of violence and there was talk about a revolution and there was socialism was on the rise, it seemed, how are we going to do anything? And yet the progressive movement and the leadership of Teddy was able to get some moderate centrist kind of action. The Square Deal really appealed to the entire middle class as well, and we did move forward. So just when we think we get stuck, something happens. Or just when you think you're at the peak, as they did in 06, it starts going downward. I think we see these cycles in American history, and we can hope we'll cycle into something better than the dysfunctional one we're in now.
Right. We've been talking to Doris Kearns Goodman. We want to thank you so much for your time. And we've been talking about her book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. This is Gene Bradley for KBOO Radio, and thanks for your time.
Oh, Gene, thank you for yours. Wonderful set of questions.
Well,
Wow. Thanks.
It's a wonderful book, and really appreciate it. And good luck on your rest of your tour.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care now.
I'm so glad we could talk. I hope we can talk again.
Well, I look forward to it. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Framing national discourse around identity and social change. The long-awaited return comes with classic soul music and jazz that showcase artists Billie Holiday, Curtis Mayfield, Gil Scott-Heron, and important artists of the era. So tune in for the special series Saturdays, September 13th and 20th from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., The Motif.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Oregon Tradeswoman presentation, My Walk Has Never Been Average, on Friday, September 26th at 7 p.m. My Walk Has Never Been Average is a multimedia presentation based on the lives of women whose stories are rarely told. Adapted for the stage from interviews with Black women in all aspects of construction, these stories reveal great inner strength and accomplishment. That's My Walk Has Never Been Average on Friday, September 26th. 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland, Oregon. For more information, that can be found at kboo.com. anchor.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And that wraps up public affairs for this morning on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned because the noon news headlines are coming up and immediately followed by the World Beat Connection. Charlie Rooney's here to bring you World Beat Connection, and we're going to go first to the noon news headlines. Thanks a lot for tuning into KBOO today, and okay, see you tomorrow.
Now for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, September 18th, 2014. Cooler temperatures and rain are good news for Estacada's wildfire. The wildfire, which covers an area of more than 4,000 acres of the Mount Hood National Forest, showed little growth or activity yesterday, thanks in part to the change in weather. The Estacada wildfire is part of a long year of wildfires exacerbated by the ongoing drought in the western United States. Though heat is expected to return this weekend, the cooler season should be here to stay. Highway 244, which runs through the area, is still closed as the fire has made it unsafe. 120 homes in the area are on evacuation warning. A report released yesterday found racial disparities in the health of Multnomah County infants. According to the report, infants born to mothers from non-white backgrounds are more likely to die before birth and be born prematurely than those born to white mothers. The report also found that children born to non-white mothers are more likely to be underweight, which can lead to a number of health problems later in life. County officials say that these disparities are the result of racial discrimination. While the report found disparities along economic and educational lines, these were not as pronounced as those pertaining to race. Almost 3,000 individuals in the United States have had their student debt paid off in full. The organization Rolling Jubilee announced on Tuesday that it bought $4 million worth of debt and paid it off. Student debt is a growing problem in the United States. Nationally, individuals owe about $1.2 trillion in student debt. All of the debt that Rolling Jubilee paid off was owed to the for-profit Everest College. That same day, the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issued a suit against Everest's parent company, Corinthian Colleges, for predatory lending. Rolling Jubilee first made headlines in November of 2012 by paying off $15 million of medical debt.